explain.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Robert Klein representing ERPBL1 LLC and ERPBL3 LLC. Please excuse me a little under the weather today. Your Honors, this is an appeal from findings of facts and conclusions of law that were entered on October 1st, 2009, that resulted in an order granting the plaintiff's motion to enforce a so-called settlement agreement. By this time in the proceedings before the circuit judge, summary judgments have been granted, as you folks know from the record, to ER on all the substantive issues. But sometime in July or just before July, the court ordered a settlement status conference and had the parties come to Hilo to attempt to work out a settlement while the case was still pending. And this culminated in an on-the-record discussion where opposing counsel and myself, representing the various parties, placed the preliminary settlement agreement on the record. And you have that record in front of you. And after that so-called preliminary settlement was placed on the record, because there were many open issues, the parties engaged in further discussions to illuminate the major points that remained outstanding after the preliminary settlement agreement was placed on the record. And these post-July 10 settlement discussions went on for months and months. Drafts of documents were exchanged, drafts of position papers were exchanged. And for the most part, I think the parties were able to narrow their issues. But in one particular area, and that's with respect to the grandfathered rights that were being accorded to ER entities, parties were never really able to reach an agreement, particularly on the definitions of affiliates, successors, and assigns. In other words, which entities would accede to the grandfathering rights, these very valuable rights that ER intended to keep, grandfather rights to use the property as a destination club even after new CCNRs were enacted, which would restrict further use for destination clubs and timeshares. These discussions broke down over that last issue. Consequently, the plaintiffs filed a motion to enforce the settlement agreement, and the court issued an order to enforce, as I said, on October 1st, and we, the defendants, filed an appeal of that order. In the appeal, we noticed error that the court, in holding that the terms placed on the record in this July 10, 2008, settlement conference on the record discussion and the post-conference negotiations were not the equivalent of an enforceable settlement agreement. The standard on appeal is similar to the standard in reviewing a summary judgment. The court can start all over, look at the purported settlement agreement, review the record, and come to a different conclusion in the court below that there was an enforceable settlement agreement placed on the record.
Mr. Klein, the standard that you're referring to, the summary judgment standard, comes from the Miller Manual case, which is an ICA decision. In the Miho case, which is a Supreme Court decision, the standard of review there suggests that with regards to whether the parties in fact entered an agreement is a question of fact, and then that would be a clearly erroneous review for us, and also that we should look at the totality of the circumstances in determining the validity of the settlement agreement. And ultimately, the enforceability of the agreement is reviewed de novo. Given all of these standards, how do you reconcile Miho and Miller versus Manuel?
Well, I suppose somebody was destined to cite the Miho case in a brief. Unfortunately, it was us. We also cited Miller versus Manuel. I look at it this way. I mean, because essentially a settlement agreement is a contract, then you apply the law of contracts. Was there a meeting of the minds on all the terms essential to the contract? And whatever standard of review you're going to use, you still have to come to a conclusion that as a matter of law, the parties met, their minds met, they agreed, they have an enforceable agreement on all the essential points. And if you are dealing with conclusions of law, naturally you'll be reviewing them de novo. If there are factual issues, then you're going to review them on a clearly erroneous standard. But because you have to look at the totality of the circumstances, you are going to have to come to a conclusion that as a matter of law, the parties' minds met and there was an agreement on all of the major issues in the case.
On July 10th, 2008, at that settlement conference put on the record,
beyond? You're correct, Your Honor. It's limited to that day because, in fact, that was the subject of the motion to enforce the settlement agreement that the plaintiffs filed and got a ruling on. Because that's exactly what the judge did. He looked and he said, in my view, using whatever test he was using, I believe Miho was cited below to him, he said there was a meeting of the minds on all the essential terms of the contract, and therefore, to my shock and dismay, you have a settlement agreement. And the settlement agreement occurred on July 10th on the record in front of him when we put the preliminary agreement on the record. And the burden is on the opposing side to show that, in fact, there was assent to the terms, the material terms of the agreement. It's their burden because they're seeking to uphold the settlement agreement at this point. One thing we do agree on is that the grandfathering term, the fact that ER would continue to operate as the destination club despite the newly amended CC&Rs that we were working on and were ordered to agree with, ultimately. The grandfathering clause is an essential term. We don't have to worry about that discussion about whether it's material to the agreement. It is. We feel that the grandfathering rights are indeed unclear. I mean, if you read the transcript, pretty much every time I mentioned the concept, opposing counsel had a different view. Every time I said one thing, she had a qualifier. There really was no meeting of the minds. And one might ask, what did the plaintiffs get out of the settlement agreement? What did they obtain? If ER had the right, grandfathering rights as broad as I expected and wanted them to be, then the destination club activities could continue even beyond ER's affiliates and assigns to its successors could continue. So how did that benefit the other side? And the answer to that is, at least they knew the devil they knew, there's only going to be one destination club operating. Before those CC&Rs, based on the decisions the court made on summary judgment, it was Paula Beach was wide open to multiple clubs coming in and running destination resort operations. So the idea of the grandfathering clause was to allow ER, its affiliates, its assigns and successor entities to continue to use the destination club operation into an uncertain time period.
It seemed like there was some kind of discussion was, is a successor a subsidiary or affiliate, or is it a third party? Is it sold as a whole to a successor affiliate or a third party? I mean, is that the We can read the transcript. We all can read, we all read the transcript in terms of what was said on the record.
I think the transcript accurately reflects what was said on the record. I mean, my point was, if ER is sold, obviously sold to a third party, that the in whole, that the destination club operation could continue. That is not how it ultimately came out when the judge inflicted his own version of that on us in his settlement order. It actually took plaintiff's side, and it implies that if we sell it to a third party, that the destination club operation must cease. That's the argument opposing counsel made, to limit the scope of the grandfather clause. My position was exactly opposite. It should be as broad as can be, because we don't know what the future is going to hold.
If in fact, under the totality of the circumstances test or standard that's set out in MIHO, we should be looking beyond and at the beyond July 10th of 2008 and the negotiations that occurred thereafter, was there a meeting of the minds thereafter on these points? And at some point, the issue of the insurer came in, or was it Capital Point or Capital Source?
It was the lender.
Lender. Yeah. So what was there at any point in this subsequent to the settlement conference, putting the so-called agreement on the record, at which point the parties had an agreement as to the grandfather clause?
Well, the short answer is no. The parties never had an agreement on that. I mean, if you look at the drafts that were traded, essentially they had one view as to successor, the term successor. We had another broader view because we had to take into account Capital Source, our lender, that in the event that they foreclosed, and of course the record indicates that these definitions were reviewed with the lender, if the lender had to foreclose and took back the destination club operation, the properties that were used as a destination club, their value might be seen as the lender, to the lender as a destination club. So it made sense that the lender, and therefore us, pursuant to our lending agreements, would want to preserve that use as a destination club because of the value of those properties as a destination club and as security for the lender.
But given the record, though, that wasn't the only issue that was outstanding.
There were several other issues, yes, Your Honor, you're correct. And one was the, of course, the wording of the amended CC&R. The other was on transient rental use. I think those are the three major areas of discussion that went on for months and months. I mean, even if you use a totality of the evidence test, which is a rather imprecise test but allows you to look beyond the actual date that the settlement was put on the record, yet beyond all of that, the same major sticking point that was unclear on July 10th, 2008, was unclear months and months and months thereafter. We could never get to a definition that was satisfactory. And finally, pursuant to their motion, the judge just sort of slammed it home. He said, this is what you meant, and this is what you agreed to, which, it is the basis for this appeal. Does the court wish me to pursue our second appeal at this time from the second settlement enforcement order? Thank you. As I said, the first settlement enforcement order, which we just discussed, was on appeal. The parties were still working towards some kind of an agreement. We couldn't reach an agreement, so it prompted plaintiffs to file a motion for an order to show us in contempt for disregarding the judge's order that required us to work together towards a settlement, towards a solution. And the judge held a hearing on the motion for order to show cause why we should be held in contempt. I think importantly, did not find us in contempt because the judge stated, I really don't have a clear order as to how the CCNR should read. At that point, that was a stumbling block. But I'll tell you how they should read. And imposed on the parties his construction of the CCNR that would prevent other destination clubs from establishing operations at Poa Beach. And the point of error in this appeal is fairly straightforward. While the appeal was pending in this court for the first settlement enforcement order, the court was divested of jurisdiction to make any further determinations on the status of the settlement, the status of the matters that he felt were still before him. And he didn't make minor adjustments. He violated HRCP 62C, which is designed to preserve the status quo while a case is on appeal, by making major adjustments to the case while the gut issue is on appeal. What were the major adjustments that he made? Well, there were multiple. If I can have a second. As this court knows, the idea of 62C, which applies in this case, is to preserve the status quo, so you don't have two courts operating at cross purposes. The three major changes that the court ordered in the second enforcement order constituted material alterations because, first, the court took over the responsibility that it had in the first settlement enforcement order required the parties to deal with, and which is defining the term successor in science. The court just went ahead and did that to the exclusion of ER's lender's rights, as we discussed earlier. Another material alteration was that the court ordered ER's, quote, affiliates and related entities to vote their shares for these amended CCNRs, which clearly changed the status quo. And the judge recognized it. He said, okay, here is a proposed CCNR amendment. Now, UER entities, affiliates, and assigns, all of UER entities who hold voting shares, you must cast your votes for this amendment to the CCNRs. But then he realized that if in fact that happened and the CCNRs were changed, how do you unring the bell if the first appeal is successful as far as ER is concerned? If you have no settlement, then how do you go back and unring the bell? The judge recognized that, which is why he entered a stay in the enforcement of the second enforcement order. He stayed that. So there has never been a vote on his version of the amended CCNRs.
Just quickly on that, is the record clear in terms of voting rights, the parties that you represent in this case, as opposed to the affiliates that the lower court ordered to vote a certain way? What's the percentages of a vote? Is there anything in the record on that?
I think you need 80% to amend, and I'm pretty sure the record shows that we didn't, ER and its affiliates didn't have 80% of the votes at the time. But the idea was if ER voted with sufficient force and power, all of its votes in favor of the CCNR amendments, others would follow it along.
So the affiliates are not parties to this lawsuit?
No, they're not. It's very clear, Your Honor. It's the ones I represent, ER PBL 1 LLC and ER PBL 3 LLC, are the parties to the suit. And they are the ones that were sued. And finally, the judge set a timetable for the vote. It has to be done in a certain period of time, which, as I say, he then backed off of by staying the procedure because he realized he couldn't unring the bell if that were to occur and the board would change the CCNR. And then this court reversed on the first settlement offer. We submit to the court that these really are substantial changes, and that therefore would have changed the status quo, violate 62C, and that the lower court did not have the jurisdiction to do that through the second enforcement order. Unless the court has questions.
Thank you, Mr. Klein.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Bronster.
Thank you very much. I represent the appellees in this case, who are the homeowners. And with regard to the enforcement of the settlement that had been reviewed by the court, we believe that the settlement should be enforced. We believe that there was a meeting of the minds, and the court properly ruled that there was an enforceable settlement. I find myself in a little bit of an odd position, because here I am arguing an appeal to you on what is supposed to be a record that has already been submitted. And yet I find myself arguing against Mr. Klein, who was present and at the settlement conference, as was I, and we could be witnesses here. But that's not our role today. It is not our role to tell you what we perceive, what we saw. It is our role to argue, based on the record on appeal, what your consideration should be. And I found myself hearing many arguments that I do not believe are in the record on appeal, but instead were simply what Mr. Klein feels that he remembers or wanted to share with you. I will try very hard to keep my remarks to the record. And I believe that if you review the record on appeal, you will see that there was an agreement as reflected by the ultimate order of the judge.
And before you jump into the record and so forth, can you address the question that I had for Mr. Klein?
Which was the MIHO?
Miller versus Manuel, the standard there, and the summary judgment standard set out by the Intermediate Court of Appeals, and the standard in MIHO, and how you reconcile those two.
I just ran and grabbed it. Because I thought you might be going in that direction. I believe that this court is bound by the Associates Financial Services case versus MIHO. And I believe that what the court said there is that the determination as to the enforceability is reviewed de novo. But whether the parties in fact entered into an agreement is a question of fact. And it is those questions of fact that the court is bound by, is subject to a clearly erroneous test. So when the MIHO case came up, they said, we agree that with the ICA that the settlement can be coerced, and they go on and talk about that problem. But then it goes on to say that a trial court's findings of fact are reviewed under the clearly erroneous standard. And its conclusions law are reviewed under the de novo standard.
So how does that apply, though, here where we have a clear transcript from July 10th of 2008? Are we limited to that transcript in terms of our determination of whether there was a meeting of the minds on all of the essential elements of a contract?
I don't think you are, and let me tell you why. If the motion was made 2 weeks after that hearing and there had been no communications between the parties, yes, I believe you'd be bound by looking only at the transcript and ruling on that basis. But in this case, the motion was actually filed almost a year later. And during that year-long period, there were communications back and forth. So I think the starting point is clearly the transcript, and you look at the transcript, and I think that the transcript shows that there was agreement, but we'll come to that later. After the transcript, there were a number of things that were discussed. For example, one of them was, what is the appropriate definition of destination club? Well, first of all, the question is whether or not that was an essential term and whether or not it was agreed to in the hearing. We believe that it was agreed to on the record at the hearing, that there was a meeting of the minds. But what happened thereafter was that in the exchange of drafts back and forth, the parties agreed to the wording of the definition of destination club. So for your purposes, it doesn't matter whether it was agreed to at the hearing or there was a subsequent agreement of the parties. Because by the time we filed our motion, it was all in the record that there was no dispute about the definition of destination club. And I think if you look at the briefs on appeal, there does not seem to be any real argument that anything other than the grandfathering language was open and in potentially in dispute. They're claiming now that it was in dispute. I don't believe that it was in dispute at the time of the hearing. So I think you can look at the post-hearing agreements, correspondence, because either it shows that, yes, in fact, there was agreement at the time of the hearing, or two, it shows that there were subsequent agreements on these language changes.
So you're saying in the drafts of the agreements that were passed between the parties after the settlement conference hearing, it's the definition of destination club that took care of the grandfathering clause?
No, I'm just giving you certain examples
of
things that in the hearing we said we need to draft up language to define destination club. We need to draft up language on this and that. I am not suggesting that the subsequent drafts answer the question of the grandfathering. Okay? Let me tell you what I think happened with respect to the definition of grandfathering. In the subsequent drafts that went back and forth, I think we're in agreement with ER that there was no subsequent language that everybody agreed to. And what we did was we went back to the transcript and we said, we believe that there was an agreement with respect to the scope of the grandfathering. We do believe that to the extent that the grandfathering was to be with successors, that was clearly defined and agreed to at the hearing. And rather than look at the briefs, because I think there are a lot of things taken out of context, the transcript is only about 15 pages long. And if you look at the transcript, you will see on pages 10 and 11, there is a discussion of what the grandfathering issues were. Mr. Klein talked about the fact that he says, and finally, also in the CCNRs, what's grandfathered in is exclusive resorts, and I think is mentioned affiliates, subsidiaries, and successors. And he goes on. I responded and said that I think that the concern that we have with respect to the use of the term successor is we have no objection to an ER successor except if there is a change in control. And it goes back and forth a little bit with clarifications. And finally, Mr. Klein says, I agree with counsel, meaning me, that we have an agreement in principle. But the principle that we agreed to is basically that if exclusive resorts is sold completely, we have the benefit of the grandfather clause. If it's sold piecemeal, the grandfather right being separated, is a separate right to another entity, then the grandfather provision would terminate. So he went on and defined what he believed this grandfathering issue with respect to successors ought to be. The court And then I, after Mr. Klein said that, I said, and that's agreed. And the court said, well, that's different than what he thought.
Isn't there a reference to whether it's sold completely to then a third party, though? Doesn't that come into the discussion right after that?
And that's what he said. He said, if it's sold completely, then we have the benefit of the grandfather clause, meaning if it's sold completely, the rights still continue. And there was agreement on that. And what I was really stunned at in the argument earlier is that what ER now is claiming is that that is not what the court ordered. But if you look at the court order, the court issued an order that went on and had an Exhibit A. Or it talked about the language, I'm sorry. It had an exhibit, and in it, it specifically talks about the definition of successor and assigns. It also defines affiliates. And in the definition of successors and assigns, it says, a successors and assigns means any entity or entities to whom ER is sold in its entirety. So what the court did in ruling on the successor and assigns language was he adopted precisely the language that Mr. Klein had stated at the settlement hearing and that I had agreed to. That is precisely the language that, so there is no difference. The court did not reject what ER had been presenting.
But isn't the question whether you agreed at that hearing that if the ER entities were sold completely to a third party, that was different than if it was just sold completely? I mean, isn't there in the transcript, I saw the language about third parties being something that was a sticking point at that point.
Actually, Your Honor, it was not. I believe the language was, if it gets sold completely, that's fine, it's grandfathered. If it's sold piecemeal, it terminates. And that's precisely, and my language, after Mr. Klein said that, the court said, okay. Mr. Klein said, that's the concept we'll be working on. And I said, and that's agreed. And that is precisely the language that the court used. So to suggest that there was any big difference of opinion, I think, is erroneous. Now, I do want to touch...
So on that grandfather point, let me just be clear. Given the review that you're suggesting, the agreement, if one exists, is all contained in that transcript.
That's correct.
Forget what happened after that date. It's all contained in that transcript.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Now, I do want to clarify one factual thing that I think was a little bit muddled, and I'll just take a moment to do so. What happened after the hearing on the record was that there was some effort and some drafts that went back and forth to put words on some of these concepts. And with respect to all of them, except for the grandfather, there was agreement. So I think the only issue before you is the grandfather. After those drafts went back and forth a little ways, and this is in the record, ER came and said, instead of a preliminary agreement, which is an agreement that's going to cover and not settle everything, why don't we try to have a global agreement? So that there was this distinction between preliminary and global. I mean, that was the distinction that the preliminary dealt with. And there were some communications about trying to get it globally settled so that we wouldn't have to come and bother you all with all of these appeals. And in conjunction with the global settlement potential, that was the very first time that we ever heard that the lender had something to say. They never made the settlement that was on the record conditional on lender approval. They never went and said that they had to check with their lender, that they had a lender that was going to be changing this. And it was only in conjunction with the global settlement that they first raised lender issues. We had never agreed to make our settlement subject to lenders. But that's where this whole capital source issue came up, and it was in conjunction with a global. When the global fell apart, we just couldn't get to the global. We said, okay, we want the agreement that we had, the partial agreement, which was not going to settle all issues.
What was left with the partial agreement? What claims were left then? There was a counterclaim, right?
No.
Was that done already?
The partial agreement was intended to deal with ER and the CCNRs and how they would apply to ER and others. And this was to try and prevent the homeowners from going into the legislature, changing the statute, et cetera, to clarify what we believed already existed. But under the partial, we were still planning on coming to the appeal and letting you all decide whether or not this was commercial activity, et cetera. So that's why this was partial. It was still going to allow things to unfold according to a final decision. So that was what was partial, what was different from the global. So I think if you look at the transcript, you'll see that there wasn't a meeting of the minds. I believe that those factual determinations made by the court as to the meeting of the minds, I think, are governed by the Miho case, and we believe that you will agree that that it was not clearly erroneous when he determined that there had been a meeting of the minds. Let me talk briefly about what was expected to happen. The partial settlement was not going to become mooted. The settlement that we reached required that, or allowed ER to continue operating, and if they sold to a third party in full, that third party could continue operating. But that the CCNRs would be put to a vote with respect to the other the other homeowners, and regardless of how the ultimate issue came out, that CCNR change would remain. So if you ruled that it was commercial, then it would get thrown out.
Wouldn't a CCNR change vote have mooted out any appeal from the you're talking about from the summary judgment rulings? The parties contemplated still appealing the circuit court's ruling on those orders, and yet having a change in the actual language of the CCRs going forward.
And basically what would have happened is that the CCNR changes would have been there, but if the court decided ultimately that the CCNRs, that ER was commercial, that would moot out the CCNR change. But if you ruled that it was allowed, then the CCNR change would still allow ER to conduct destination clubs, but it still wouldn't allow others. And that's why the homeowners really wanted this CCNR change to come to fruition before the ultimate decision by the court, because there was a benefit. Otherwise, it would just be a stay pending coming upstairs. And that wasn't the intent. And if you look at the overall agreement, there was a benefit to both sides. ER didn't want, it made sense for ER not to want other destination clubs. And it made sense because we had one destination club, but we didn't want multiple ones. So there was a benefit to both sides in addition to preventing the homeowners from going into the legislature, et cetera. And that was one of the things that was going on while they appealed. We were not prevented from going forward with enforcing the settlement agreement that the court had found, because there was no stay requested. Initially, ER never requested a stay. And so when we went in and said, come on, let's go ahead and perform. Let's get the CC&R amendment before the homeowners, because at least we'd get some benefit. We wouldn't have, you know, the ER units would still be destination club, but we didn't want all the other units to go that way to other destination clubs. And so we said, let's go forward. That was completely consistent with the court's authority under Rule 62C. Because it was not changing anything, it was simply effectuating the ruling that the court had found, which was we had an enforceable agreement. ER had not sought a stay, and so the court was not changing anything that had gone up on appeal. It was simply acting consistent with what was going up on appeal. Mr. Klein said that there were several alterations, that the court below couldn't act because there were things that he was doing that were different from the original order. And I suggest that you look at the two orders, because I believe that they were completely consistent. He was simply effectuating his earlier order. When ER ultimately did ask him to stay at pending appeal, he agreed over our objection. But before the stay motion was made, there were no adjustments. It was simply effectuating the existing order. They say that defining successors and assigns was different, but it was no different. It was precisely the same language as what had been decided in the first order. So no change there. Second, it required people to vote. Well, that's no change either, because it was consistent with the ER defendant's requirement that they work cooperatively to get the amendment passed.
Did that include ordering the affiliates to vote a certain way, though? I mean, was that contemplated under the first preliminary agreement?
Yes, I believe it was. If you take a look at what ER's representative stated, he was there at the first, at the settlement hearing, and he stated who he was, who he was representing, and the fact that he wanted certain things for ER, not for the two specific defendants, but he was pushing for getting the ER affiliates certain rights. And it was, those rights were agreed to. And he said he was there on behalf of ER and the various ER entities. So they got a huge benefit in the settlement, because it wasn't just the two defendant entities who got these rights of grandfathering, of transferring, of everything, but with that came responsibility to vote. I don't believe that that was inconsistent with the first order, and I don't think it was an alteration in any way. But the fact of the matter is that the subsequent stay ended up handling that when they did finally ask for it. So I believe that this matter, I think the other arguments that are in the briefs are essentially re-arguing the first appeal that you heard today, that somehow there was something, you know, that it's commercial and whatnot. But I don't believe that there was anything else that we need to address. I don't believe that the court was divested of jurisdiction to enforce its own orders. And we believe that the court's findings with respect to the fact that there was an agreement should be sustained on appeal. Thank you.
Ms. Bronster,
yes.
If you were to prevail on the earlier appeal we heard today, would that have any impact on your position on this appeal?
Yes. If they came out simultaneously, we believe that the earlier appeal, if you find that, if you find that the activities are commercial and or timeshare and barred, we believe that that would moot these appeals, that there is no need to reach these issues. If you, however, ruled that it was a, there were questions of fact that required additional proceedings below, such that there would be a trial and ultimate decisions as to whether or not a timeshare was okay or not, then we would still want a decision on this because it's the homeowner's view that there is a benefit of having the CCNRs passed in the pendency of a pending final outcome. And finally, if you find that the ER's activities are allowed under the existing CCNRs, we would certainly want a decision on this because we believe that we would want to have this limitation on other destination type clubs. Because if you look at the concept of what was being considered, we were saying, okay, we're not going to, no one's going to agree that the other side was right on the positions, but we are going to agree that destination clubs going forward won't be allowed. And so that certainly is something that we would want to include. Now, ER would be able to stay, there's no question about that, but it would prevent other destination clubs. So we would want a decision on these other appeals, and we believe that we would have the right to get the CCNRs voted.
Anything else? Thank you, Ms. Foster.
Thank you.
Mr. Klein?
I want to get back to the NEHO case. The distinction between NEHO and this case is, of course, NEHO, there was an evidentiary hearing. We had no evidentiary hearing, even though the result was findings of facts and conclusions of law based on discussions on July 10th and subsequent discussions and trades of draft, trading of drafts going back and forth between the parties. But there was no real evidentiary case where these findings of facts and conclusions of law, the first settlement offer were the judges that he made up to resolve the case. So that's the distinction between, and that distinction affects the standard of review. So to that extent, we disagree with counsel. But we do agree with counsel that advocates shouldn't be testifying. It's tempting because we were the participants in the settlement conference and participated in the record. It's very tempting to tell you what we believe, what we meant. But fine line between testifying and arguing points of law, and I for one ask forgiveness if I strayed from being a witness, from being an advocate, but I think I heard similar comments reverberating when opposing counsel was arguing as well. So I would also point out, Your Honors, that the very fact that we filed an appeal from the first settlement enforcement order would normally divest the circuit judge of jurisdiction to do anything further in the case. That's the normal rule it's a judge-made rule. It's supposed to prevent confusion with different results coming from the circuit court and coming from the appellate court. And the cases we cited, the Saitu McClatchy case, is right on point. And it shows that you can, a circuit judge, when a case is on appeal, can make very minor adjustments, but can't make major adjustments. And I think when Judge Nakamura was handling the second part of the case, the result in the second settlement enforcement order, he ultimately got to the conclusion, because we did ask him for, we did ask for a stay, which he turned down, and he proceeded to wade into the case even further. He finally got to the conclusion that, yes, you know, if those CCNRs are changed, it's going to be very difficult to unring the bell if the decision in the first appeal is in favor of the appellants, us, and there is no settlement. It's going to be very difficult to unring the bell. So he voluntarily stated, why would a judge do that? The judge would do that because he knows that what he's about to do is going to affect the first appeal. It's linked. You can't do the second part without affecting the first part. That's the very reason we have 62C and its injunctive language. The judge wasn't just implementing or whatever words you want to use the first settlement order. He was affecting it, and he was affecting it greatly. He was causing entities that were not part of the case to vote for CC&Rs, which he realized that if they passed, he could not unring very easily. So I think that recognition alone is proof that even the judge recognized at that point that he may be in violation of 62C. But certainly this court should understand and recognize that. As far as the first part is concerned, when we're talking about an agreement on all fours as an enforceable contract, I think the very key point is that happens near the end of the transcript is when I have said, if ER is sold entirely, we keep the grandfather rights. Counsel retorted, he would have a problem with ER attempting to transfer its grandfathered rights to another vacation club or destination club. And it's that wording we're going to have to cobble together to define successor. That shows very clearly when you're going to be cobbling together language to define successor, and there's a distinction between our broader view of successor and their limited view of successor, that there is no meaning of the minds. I don't know how anyone could say there was, and what Judge Nakamura did was he simply accepted one side of the argument. I have nothing further unless the court has questions.
Thank you, Mr. Klein.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you both. Take the matter under advisement.